So today we're going to do Chazara. There's another source sheet for him. It's one page. It's summary. So I reorganized things a little bit. Try to bring everything together. Make some comments about what we covered, what we didn't cover. And then I want to hear feedback. While we're talking about. Things are still unclear. I've edited a few things here. What questions do you think still need to be covered? Which we're not going to cover this year because we're going to do test cases because it's important at some point. I got an email this morning from Ari Lam, Rabbi.
What's he doing?
Rabbi Ari Lam? I don't know what Ari's doing next year. You can ask him. Ari, if you're listening.
You're supposed to find
it out for me. Yes. So Ari, a friend of mine, Ari pointed out that one of the things we didn't really cover. Which I knew we didn't get to. We spoke mostly the perspective of post-skim, of people who are making the decisions. We really didn't speak about the role of the people asking the questions, the role of Balabatim and Psak. I was thinking about trying, if you guys are interested, Judah and Shana together co-wrote an article in the Orthodox Forum in 2010 on Balabatim-centered Psak. Both from his experiences in medicine and her perspectives from being a yoetzet, of maybe having him give a shiur or them give a shiur, whatever, discussing their perspective. It's an interesting article, but I'm sure they thought about it more. Maybe we'll find a way of talking about it. I don't think we're going to get to it this year, but if that's something people are interested in, Judah's around. I'll try to ask him. It's already on recording. I'll ask whatever. It's a good article either way. I think it's called Balabatim Centered Sock. Gil Student's article in that same Orthodox tradition also deals with the question of, I quoted a little bit last week, but deals with the changing role of the local rabbinate and Rosh Yeshiva and how people choose who they ask questions to and different authority and from that perspective, also the responsibilities of post-skim to ensure that people are going to the right address, but it's it deals with both sides of the question. But there's a lot of shahs that we didn't talk about. We touched on why a psak is binding, but we didn't touch on what it means to actually ask a shayla. We did legally, but what goes into it? Right? Clapper likes talking about, one of the things he learned in his more yeshivish upbringing, and he went through Breuer's and whatever, and this is central in the yeshivish world and less in ours, the fundamental value, religious value of asking a shayla, of willing to take an answer, even if you don't necessarily know why, or you don't necessarily agree, and these are things that are worth talking about. Ari encouraged me to put a series together on this. I agree it's important. I don't think we're going to get to it this year, but who knows? Maybe next year. Anyway, so today I just want to talk about what we've done, like I just did, what we haven't done, and then. After this, we're going to start doing some test cases. Okay, the last practical point here is what I put at the top is throughout this Zman, I've summarized all the Shirim, some with better summaries, some with worse summaries. They're all online at the website here, which is a blog that I basically use to put Torah thoughts. If you look there, you'll see that there are also follow-ups to the Shirim, that a lot of times when I got follow-up questions or found follow-up sources, I didn't have another shiur on the topic here, but I did integrate it into another written piece, which would be follow-up, and those are online. So if anyone's interested, you're free to look. And if everyone look back at a shiur, the shiur are all on YU Torah with the sources, and the summaries are all on the blog. Okay. What?
Dot
word, is it?
Yeah.
Dot word. There you go. So I'll change that before I put it on when I put the official source on YU Torah. Okay. Fine. So the first week, we dealt with background question, the theoretical question. What does it mean for something to be true halachically? And we raised a lot of possibilities everywhere from, are there multiple truths within halacha, multiple things that can actually be true? Not everything is true, but there are multiple possibilities. And therefore, what the process of psak actually limits the possibilities that can be implemented in practice. And that's what we pointed out from the Ritva, the analysis of Rosh Hashanah Yisraeli, that the Ritva is the champion of this notion that Eilu Ve'eilu Divrei Elokim Chayim means that there are actually multiple truths in Psak. He's also the person who claims that the process of Psak is Shavi Chaticha D'Yisura. It creates a metaphysical status. You know, if you ask a Rav and he says this object is not kosher, it becomes not kosher to you. Because if there are multiple possibilities, the halakhic process itself creates not an objective reality, but the reality that you are bound to live in, bein l'kula, bein l'chumra. While Rosh Hashanah Yisraeli thinks it's only l'chumra, in the Ritva it's clear not the way, as Rav Henkin points out in B'nai Banim, Chelek Gimel, Tshuva Chet. That was one limit. There was one possibility. The other extreme, the possibility that there's really only one truth. We're trying to get that one truth. The reason you follow Pasuk Psak, it's your best chance at getting to that one truth. In between, you have, there's only one truth, but we're not bound to it. We're bound, this is Ramosha's formulation, we're bound to the Emet Lahora'ah, not the Emet La'amito. We're bound by the halakhic process. Again, why this is justifiable philosophically, perhaps because, as the Ran says, it's the best possible system, and therefore God forgives us when we make mistakes, even though you did something objectively wrong, ein ma la'asot. God wanted you to follow the system because you'll get it right the most number of times, and therefore you're forgiven if you make mistakes. Terry Nevetsky, in a email that responded to my first year, noted that Rav Amital in the Sicha actually goes farther than Rav Moshe, and actually says differently. He said, no, there's an objective truth, and then there's an Emet Lamito and Emet Lahara'ah. It's not that we try to get to Emet Lamito, but we suffice with Emet Lahara'ah. We don't care about Emet Lamito, because Emet Lamito is Emet Shamaimit, and we care about human truth. And therefore, it's not just that we are bound to Emet Lahara'ah, we actually couldn't care less about Emet Shamaimit. That's not the type of truth we're bound to, which is a more radical theological claim. Yeah, I can send it out to people. It was an old Sikha. I was actually, I think, in yeshiva for it. I think it was more than once. When he said it, I was like, oh, that's true. And Alex and I were both there, and we're like, right. It's interesting. It's a very radical theological position. I don't know how much it was drash and how much it's not, but...
How different is that from the Ritva? And the Ritva says there are multiple truths.
Right, so Rwanda said there's one truth and we don't care.
So
there's different types of truth, really. There's Emet Shamaimit and Emet Enoshit.
Right, but in order to have Amital Shita, then the Emet Shamaimit has no mouth to him, so there's no particular reason for it to exist. So it's
right, I don't know. Meaning, practically, I don't know. It's just sort of as a theological notion. It's very radical. Anyways, then when we pointed out, I should have put this here, we can add it in. The next question we asked was, does this matter for Psak? So I said, look, and this is Rosenzweig's point in his article in Eilu Ve'eilu Divrei Elokim Chayim, is that at some level it really doesn't matter. That, you know, it could go either way. That if you believe that there are multiple truths, so on the one hand, whether someone says Usher, whether someone says Mutter, they're tapping into some metaphysical truth. On the other hand, if what binds us is the process, it may be that it doesn't matter whether something is true in theory. It's not true by process, and therefore it's illegitimate to follow. On the flip side, if you hold Ramosha Shita, you could say, look, on the one hand, yes, we're seeking the ultimate truth, but since we're not bound to that, we're bound to the Emet Lahora'ah, that actually frees us up in a certain sense, because, you know, maybe if two legitimate positions are both Emet Lahora'ah, it doesn't matter if only one of them, or even neither of them, are the Emet Lamito. So it doesn't actually necessarily translate, but psychologically it does. Perspective-wise it does. When you're thinking about what it means to ask a Shaila, to answer a Shaila, to dodge a Shaila, right? To give it over to another posek. Things that are not necessarily bound up in formal process, the people's perspective on the halakhic system obviously does affect how they ask and answer questions. The example I gave at the time of the posek, I discovered at the time that in addition to the posek I was thinking about, Reb Chalcin did the same thing, where someone came to him with a abortion shayla, and he sent them the Tzitz Eliezer, which is a decision which is not a decision, right? He's giving the decision over to someone else. He knows the conclusion, but he formally is not involved in the decision.
In terms of whether there's an opinion to your perspective, wouldn't someone who thinks that there are multiple truths be more inclined to take a more radical or extreme position, which is not normative, because of the recognizing that as being true.
So not necessarily. That's what Rosenzweig points out, is that by maximizing the number of theoretical truths, you emphasize the importance of the process. And it might be that lemaisa, therefore, the only one thing would be true, because once you say there are multiple truths, the only thing that limits you or binds you to a specific one is the halachic process. So it could be that you would actually have a more radical notion of psak, or that psak actually cuts off possibilities.
Only according to the Moshe version, but not...
No.
Or the Amital version, or in theory of the Ritva, where...
Because that's the point, right? The Ritva himself, and this is where Israeli points out, holds that there are multiple truths, but a psak creates one truth, and now you're bound halachically to that truth. Right? So it doesn't necessarily go hand in hand, because the fact is that halacha has spoken. Right? Now, you could say that in this particular case it hasn't, but what if you think it has? Right? You know, the... you know, you see this type of language. You know, even in you know, we'll come back to the same issues that keep coming up in the modern, in like sort of the last few months, the Tillin controversy, right? You'll see a lot of people have been saying it really could have been otherwise. In fact, the Gemara seems to be otherwise from the Ramah. But Malaso, Minagashkenaz, is to follow the Rabban, the Nosei Kelim, and the Rabban Nosei Kelim all said it in Malaso, even if it is another possibility, because process has bound us up in the decision of the Rabban. They're not arguing that the Rabban is automatically right. It's actually a little bit weird to say that, oh, we go against the, you know, at least one posek I saw just said, yeah, we don't paskin like the Bavli on this one, we paskin like the Yerushalmi and the Psikta, which is a very strange methodological move. But they were bound by process. Right, even though they thought it might not be true, right? So it's not necessarily, they don't necessarily go hand in hand. They could, but they don't have to. Okay, so that was the first week. That was a little bit minutiae from everything we did after that. That was theory. Then we moved to trying to analyze what it is that actually goes into making a halachic decision, and we divided the last. I think it's 20. That's the number I have. I thought it was 21, but 20 shiurim, I think. 20. I was off by a number, yeah. At some point I lost count. Okay. We dealt with both normative, like classic cases of psak, what goes into a basic ABC, you know, just basic elementary decision, and what happens in the outlying cases. So I tried to reorganize the shiurim conceptually now, not in the order that we did them. We did them in one logical order, but now that we've gone through it, I can reorganize a little bit. Okay, so we started with the very basics of psak and noted that usually there are three basic building blocks of psak, three things that have to be balanced when making a decision, which were, I have them here, but, you know, or analysis of the original sources, precedent of authority, and custom, both minag poskim, both minag of people. Those are three things that people balance in different ways. And we noted just in terms of describing, without even getting into which is better, which is worse, just describing what poskim do when you read the introduction to the Beis Yosef. What's emphasized is precedent of authority. The Shlosha Amudei Hora'ah, the Rush, the Rif, and the Rambam, at least his stated methodology is best of three, which is a very strongly authority-driven notion of psak. Now, we point out that there are problems because it assumes a rove of an arbitrary three poskim, which is problematic for a lot of reasons. You know, you can solve it if you remember from when Yitzchak Yosef came, that the only shayla that he knew his father had forgotten ever was the Tshuvas Radbaz that he showed him, who said the reason the Beis Yosef chose the Shloshet Amudei Hora'ah was
because
they had seen everything and represented Rov Klal Yisrael until that point. And therefore it was a Mamish Rov Minyan Rov Binyan, right? It was a Rov Gamur, but that's not obvious. We noted that the Ramah his stated goal, besides for claiming that the Beis Yosef isn't true to his own goals, and therefore he's going to respond, notes that what is he adding to the cheshbon? Minag, especially Minag Ashkenaz. First of all, practical Minag, but also the Sifrei Minag of Ashkenaz, Maharil, Mahariwayel. And the polemicist against this entire enterprise was the Yamshel Shlomo, Shlomo Luria, who claimed that no, that's not how Psak works. Psak, in each generation, people have to analyze the original sources. And we noted that it's not as if any of these won out. In the time of Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, the combination of authority and minhag was the primary mode, and that was really very, very strong for a few hundred years, for the era of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah and the Magen Avraham and the Shach and the Taz. But the Gra was known for what? Right, for his own analysis. And that method was brought back very strongly into the world of Ashkenaz through the Gra, through the Talmidei Agra. First in the world of Lamdas, but also in the world of Psak. You see it in the Shagas Aryeh. You see it in later Litvish Poskim. And you see it, and as we talked about the Mishnah Brura Aruch HaShulchan, in the Mishnah Brura you see a Shiluv. That the Mishnah Brura, part of the Mishnah Brura, tends to be very authority-based. But the Bir Halacha is exactly what it sounds like. He's understanding the Sugyos himself. While in the Mishnah Brura he's very authority-based, in the Bir Halacha he challenges the Ramah. The Ramah's claim that you're allowed to write, that writing on Shabbos, bela'az, is only derabanan, and therefore is mutter, amira, lenachri, writing, b'makom mitzvah, because it's shvus tishvus. And he rejects it because it seems to be against the sugyas. And he's probably correct. Yeah.
Regarding Mishnah Berurah, which came first? Was like
they're written together.
No, I'm sorry. Which derech was based on the other? Was he came to the Pesach based on authority and then try to read into this?
No, they're multiple psakim. You'll see. He doesn't always pass them the same way. He'll say, this is what's authority, but... Now, Mishnah Berurah tends to try to be machmer for both. That's just his decision. Right, so... But not necessarily, right? Sometimes he'll say, yesh lahachmer, yesh lahakel, yesh noag, and bal nefesh yachmer, right? It's a complex balance of the two. And it usually comes at the Kohen because he has two ways he could be machmer on any given shayla, which is not a good thing, right? If you're looking for kulos... You could also go the opposite, be Mekel in both directions. He happened not to have done such a thing. Fine. The Aruch HaShulchan, we pointed out, that seems to be Mishalev to other methodologies, which is independent analysis. Right? First thing you notice with the Aruch HaShulchan is that you open up to any siman, what does he start with? The Gemara, or even the Psukim. He does an independent analysis of the Sugya, tells you what he thinks. He brings in authority, but only insofar as he agrees with them. But what drives him in a way that doesn't drive the Mishnah Berurah? Minhag, which is one of the reasons that Rav Henkin Sr. and Rav Henkin Jr. quoting him felt that in many ways the Aruch HaShulchan is more authoritative than the Mishnah Berurah. So that was just sort of the overall three building blocks of Psak. Now, throughout the year, though, we pointed to certain things that considerations you have to take in each of these that are not so obvious. For example, in analysis of the original sources, just 2 weeks ago, we noted that one of the questions that you're going to have to ask sometimes is what original sources? Only legal texts, or what about narrative? And if you remember on the Purim, when we were giving Sharon the drinking on Purim, we noted that much of the halachic discussion is driven by how do you understand the potential relationship of the narrative to the psak. Does it modify? Does it reject? Does it accept? So when we're talking about canon, we're talking about analysis of original sources, one of the questions you have to ask is what sources? Legal sources or narrative sources? One of the shailas we didn't deal with this year, but it's obviously a big thing in Psak, I don't think enough that in this context we could have justified a whole shiur on it, is the question is what is the relative role of Bavli and Yerushalmi? Right? We tend to say that Bavli is always going to win. That's not the Psak of the Rambam. The Rambam integrates Bavli, Yerushalmi, and Midrashei Halacha, which complicates things because the Rambam is an important authority. So one of the things we didn't deal with, but you'll want to think about in this context, is when we're talking about sources, not just halacha versus narrative, but Bavli versus Yerushalmi, Midrash. Another thing that we dealt with was the question of manuscripts. Is, okay, well, what if it's a text in a Gemara that wasn't in front of the Rishonim? Is it, right, how do we approach it? This plays into other things also. The question of manuscripts equally affects the question of precedent. Right? It affects both the question of original texts, of analysis of original texts, and of precedent. How do you relate to mistaken texts, different realities, or new positions? Right? What are we analyzing and what are we bringing into the canon? The same thing is true of precedent. Right? In precedent, we noted, as an example, the Machlokas, the Mishkanos Yaakov, and the Beis Ephraim, is earlier Achronim claimed that Rove Rishonim held that you need 600,000 people for a Rishus HaRabim to be a Rishus HaRabim. The Mishkanos Yaakov notes that if you actually count up the Rishonim he had by his day, it was not true. It was a miut of Rishonim who thought that you needed 600,000. So he changed the Psag, the Beis Ephraim challenged him. So when we're dealing with the question of precedent, you have to ask the same question. Do we take in new shittos, or do we have a certain shlosha amudei hara'ah, a sort of winnowing of sources that are actually relevant halachically? The Chazon Ish, we pointed out, is probably the locus classicus for this in the modern era, and it's very hard to pin down his position, but as it probably was, he was very opposed to bringing in new shittos. But on the other hand, we noted that Rav Shechter, Lemaisa, his psak on Tcheles, his endorsement of Tcheles, is it based on his full-fledged assumption that you're allowed to take in archaeological evidence, manuscript evidence, anything we know that people before us legitimately didn't know changes it. It uproots precedent, right? It reframes how we understand the sources we're dealing with. But we noted that's a heated machlokas among poskim, is how do you relate to these? Similarly, in the role of precedent, or analysis of original sources, however you want to put it, was the question of the role of Kabbalah. Right? When we talk about the original sources, do we include the Zohar? Do you think that the Zohar is Tanaitic? Even if you think it's Tanaitic, does that mean it's a primary source? Because we don't actually paskin Rishonim by Yochai when he argues in the Chachamim. What is its status? Is it any stronger than a Midrash, weaker than a Midrash? Even if you don't treat the Zohar as an original source, but is it a stronger... does it provide stronger precedent? Is the Zohar stronger, weaker? Which tended to be a machlokas Ashkenazim and Svardim. That, just one second, was that Svardi Psak tended to be more accepting of Kabbalah. Ashkenazi Psak, led by the Chassam Sofer, said that mixing Halacha and Kabbalah was Kilayim. It was Aser, it doesn't make sense, it's not, they don't mix. And the question is asked not just by the Zohar, but by the Arizal. And the Arizal can go both directions. The Arizal could be less powerful because the Zohar is a Tana, whatever. Whatever you believe about the Zohar. And the Arizal is obviously not. On the other hand, the Arizal could be more powerful because even if the Zohar is a Tana, it's a Tana that's not necessarily accepted. The Arizal is working within our canon and is both a Chacham and a Navi, as some of the Achronim were Menaseachit. And as we noted, that traditionally Svardi Psak took Kabbalah very seriously, but who changed it around? Ravadia. That Ravadia really went back, and in this sense, really passed like the Ashkenazim. So again, both in the question of what are the original sources and the question of precedent, besides the sort of ABCs of how do you balance them, you still have to ask, what sources are we talking about? What authorities are we talking about? What about new sources, new authorities? And what about Kabbalah? Where does it fit? How does it fit as an authority? How does it fit as a primary text? Ilan?
Speaking of the on this sheet, you put his tendency to paskin like the Shulchan Aruch under the Minhag section. Is it clear from his tendency to do that he does it because he honestly believes that that is Minhag Sephard, or Eruv HaMisrach in some sense of the word, or is it more because he believes that it's the most authoritative and trustworthy text?
So, the Ovadia is a little bit complicated, because on the one hand, yes, he has a sort of a propensity to explaining why he thinks the Beis Yosef is the greatest person ever, and he likes quoting the Hakdama to Magen Meisharim, where Rabbi Yosef Karo doesn't say about himself, but he says about himself, do you know how the Magen worked? How he claims the Magid worked. The Magid spoke through his own voice. Like he would hear himself talking. Right? And that was the angel talking to him. So he verbalized about himself. That Rabbi Yosef Karo is Mechabarna Rabba Deret Yisrael, Pasakna Rabba Deret Yisrael, Murad Asra Deret Yisrael, Asher Melech Malchei Amlochim Chafetz Bikaro. So you do have this rhetoric in Rabbi Avadya, but what would indicate that it's really about Minag? Remember from the Yom Iyun? Because he only cares about Sephardim, and what does he say about Ashkenazim? What?
Are we just supposed to be
Sephardi? No. He says, yes, really you should be Sephardi, but what does he say, Lamaisa?
We're our own thing.
Yeah, he says, Anu Mishalanu, Vehem Mishalahem.
So he really thought it was the most authoritative.
Right, so there's a tension in Rabbi Avadya. But let's get to that now, right? So then, the third axis was Minog, which we ended up spending two full shirim later on about Minog, two different aspects to it. And we point out there's many different types of psa, for the Minog. Right, the classic minag in the Gemara is minag hamakom. Right, what in the Gemara the classic case is minag hamakom, which is binding, definitely in terms of just minhagim, right, which are not halachic, and probably but not 100%, even in terms of minag haposkim, right, if the minag of a certain place is to poskim like a certain person, that has halachic weight. This is the nusach of the tumim, famously in some chafhei. That the minug of Europe was the Sephardim Paskin, like the Machaber and Ashkenazim Paskin, like the Ramah. Now again, the Gra militated against this and didn't really believe in minug aposkim in that sense. He believed in analysis of original sources and therefore would overturn minug. But people took minug aposkim very seriously and treated it as a form of minug hamako. Bismanazeh, we don't really have minug hamako. Right, we all live in communities that are mixed of different people. Povisham, they're minag hamakom. I said the minag hamakom I can really think of is the minag eretz Yisrael, not to wear tefillin and cholamoed. But there aren't so many things I can think of that are really, really minag hamakom. Right? Like I said, in the Alon Shvat Shul, the fact that every davening, depending on who's chazan, they switch the sign to say Ashkenaz or Sfarad, tends to militate against the notion that there's a authoritative minag hamakom. That being said, what we really need to ask is minag avos. What is the status of minag avos? Because that's what we really talk about. So here, Rabbi Avadya and others think that there is a direct translation from Minag HaMakom into Minag Avos. And therefore, if people in Svarad were bound by the Beis Yosef, then Svaradi people of Svaradi descent, are also bound by the Beis Yosef. And the same with the Ramah. If you don't believe that's true, so then, and this was Rav Shlomo's critique, if you remember, in the eulogy for Rav Avadya, which turned into a hour-long critique of anything Rav Avadya ever did. I love Rav Avadya, he's the Gadol HaDor, but this is not a psak ever worked, and it's a ziyuf. Rav Shlomo Levi, you remember this?
Yeah.
Rav Shlomo is a very charity person. I love Rav Avadya, but apparently Rav Shlomo likes him less. And this is a question that you really have to ask, is how does Minag Avos translate halachically? Now, to put it in perspective, as I said before, this, I think, at some level, was one of the key questions that was asked during the Tillin controversy. Right? Because if you read some of the things, not really Rav Shechter's, right? Rav Shechter's Tshuva read differently, but if you read some of the things that were being written, this was Rabbi Weider's position, for example, his argument basically went, the Ramah and all the Nosei Kelim all said that what? The women don't wear tefillin, and therefore it is Minog Ashkenaz. I said to him, and I said this to Rav Schreiber also, because I had the same discussion with Rav Schreiber. I said, Rebbe, with all due respect, the logical conclusion of that argument is that, I've said this to several of you, that it was Usher in S.A.R. and Ramaz, and it would be Mutter in Flatbush. Right, which lit Afianius Daiti was a reductio ad absurdum. Rabbi Weider, who is one of the most intellectually consistent people I've ever met, said that he believed that not exactly that was true, but that yes, had it been a Svardi, it would have been Mutter. Because his argument really was, he really does basically take the Rabbi Avadya-esque position about Minag Ashkenaz, and therefore it is Minag Ashkenaz, and therefore for a Svardi to do it, it wouldn't have been a problem. My response, and again, you know, miyani umani lahachnas roshi into this argument. Rishreiber was moda to me though after I said it, and I saw Rav Tversky actually said this also yesterday in the piece that was republished. And his position was that even if I'm correct, that I'm a little bit reticent to directly apply these notions of minhag Ashkenaz, minhag Svard to people now, that might come out of Chumrah, because it might be that women not wearing tefillin is minhag Yisrael, because lo ra'inu Ashkenazim or Svardim who had the women wear tefillin. And so it could cut both ways. You could on the one hand say, yes, the Ramah and all they know say Kalim or Machmir, and therefore, you know, and therefore Ashkenazim are have to be, have to say it's Usher, and Svardim are free to say it's Mutter like the Rambam. And then it could cut Lukula, right? You could say that there's no such thing as Minhag HaMakom, and therefore we live in America, we can choose not to Paskin like the Rama, and therefore it would be Lukula. You could say that no, it's Minhag HaMakom, it's not Minhag HaMakom, it's Minhag Yisrael, and therefore that would lead you to conclude that it's Lachumra, it's also for Svardim or Ashkenazim. These are all possibilities. It just, part of the discussion has to be figuring out exactly where we stand in terms of the traditional Klalei Psak that Lefi and Yisdaiti have to be at least thought about when you live in a world of mixed Ashkenazim and Svardim. That doesn't mean that necessarily we don't just follow the old Psak, but it might mean that. The other just point here is that even if you don't think that the minhag we have now is binding midin magom magom, it might still be a strong, it might provide a strong pull or a strong predisposition to pass in a certain way, even if it's not binding, right? Minhag avos doesn't have to be formally minhag hamakom for it to be strong, and this is the point that the Chavos Yarim makes and the Pesach Yehuda makes. Right? It's not binding. It's not minhag hamakom, but it's something. Right? It's not nothing. No one ever claimed it was nothing. Yoni,
how do you determine whether it's minhag or just lack of something?
So that's hard. I'm not saying I'm convinced that it is usher. I'm just pointing out that it could lead to chumrah and say it's minhag Yisrael. Again, you always have to ask: is it lo ra'inu in araya? Right, because. Or do you say that no, the Beshita adopted the Minag Ashkenazim? It's hard to tell. In certain things, it's true. In Nida, for example, Svardim adopted the Chumras of Ashkenaz. Rabbi Avadia was livid and claimed that this was just a Ziyuf and pushed very hard in Taras Abayis to push back on it. Mordechai Eliyahu always critiqued Rabbi Avadia and said, what are you talking about? The Minag of at least Iraq, you know, the Chalabim, the Lebanese, was to follow Minhag Ashkenaz. The fact that Rabbi Yosef Karo didn't follow Minhag Ashkenaz is completely irrelevant. That was not the Minhag. And there are cases where you see that.
In terms of the, you just mentioned the Tefillin issue, so the Ramah versus, again, like, from somewhere else, would there be an Achmin
or Melchim? Maybe. No. When I gave Sharon Minhag, I pointed out that it's one of the hardest things to really pin down, but these are just things to think about. The classic models of Minhag, of Minhag HaMakom, Minhag Avos, Minhag HaPoskim, Minhag Yisrael, and how they translate into a world where, in many senses, Minhag is broken down, and new Minhagim have been created, right? How do you relate to that? In that context, we talked about the flip side of Minhag, which is Lotus Gozidu. In addition to the question of why is a minhag binding, there's the negative, which is sometimes you can't do something because you can't split from the community. Within Lo Tizkodu, we dealt with the machlokes, within the Gemara, within the Rishona, within the Acharonim, how do you paskin? Does Lo Tizkodu only apply to halacha or even to minhag? Lechkula, only lechomra or even lechkula? And we noted that the svaros seem to be, and this is as it's pointed out in the Nitziv, is that Lotus Godu can be driven by one of two theories. Either Shelo Yasa Torah Kishtei Toros, that we don't want the Torah to look like there are two different traditions, and we don't want to cause machlokes. And we pointed out that maybe what's behind this distinction between minhag and not minhag, if it's about Shelo Yasa Torah Kishtei Toros, people having different minhagim, doesn't attack that, because the Torah is the same, the minhagim are different, but it can cause machlokes. if you think about machlokes, right, you would tend to be machmir. What I talked about then is that in addition to the technical halachic questions, I think the broader question to think about there is that when communities decide to split over issues to, you know, schism to an extent, schisms are often driven by machlokes, but they often result in less machlokes because now the two communities function as different communities. On the level of machlokes, sometimes it's better to say we agree to disagree. On the level of Shalayasa Turkish Tei Torahs, it's worse because you're actually giving up and you're recognizing now there's two traditions. And I noted that that's one of the things that has to be thought about in a lot of the modern discourse is by our, you know, is it necessarily a bad thing that we're always arguing? Or is there something good about that? The fact that we still recognize that we're one halachic community and that we have to look over our shoulders at the other people, that emphasizes the fact that we are one community. It might mean sometimes that we have to give up on certain practices that we would otherwise engage in. And we have to always weigh the costs on both sides. The last point just in Minhag, and again from the Purim Shir, is that I think one of the things that academic Jewish studies can help us with, or understanding of history, is to figure out what Minhag actually was, how was Halacha actually practiced, and that can then be a factor in how we paskin. And that was what we did in the Drinking and Purim Shir. I pointed out that it seems to be that Provence had a Minhag, and late Sfarad had a Minhag, not to drink on Purim. And you have to wonder, to what extent is that significant halachically, if you can uncover that. Okay, so that was sort of the first general section, was the analysis of original sources, what sources, new sources, the weight of precedent, which precedent, is it Rove? Again, Kabbalistic sources, new sources, Minhag HaPoskim, Minhag Yisrael, Minhag Avos, and the negative of Lotzis Go to do. So that was sort of section one. Any questions on section one? Okay. Section two was the question of, okay, let's say we have the theory. Next step is implementation. Because Psak is, right, the difference between Halacha and Halacha L'maaseh is... What? Is lemaisa, right? Is halacha is theoretical. It's what does the Torah say in a theoretical circumstance? Halacha is Shulchan Aruch, is the Torah, is the Mishneh Berurah. Lemaisa is when you take that, you take the principles and now you apply it. It's the difference between codes and tshuvos, right? The codes illustrate what halacha, the theoretical halacha is, Mishneh, you know, the tshuvot try to implement it. Some codes also, right? Shmir Shas Kehilchaza is in that sense a series of tshuva, right? It's let's apply the theoretical halacha into reality. So when you're deciding a shaila, what do you have to do? So the first thing you have to do is figure out what all the relevant sugyot are, and then you have to understand them, right? Which, first of all, pushes for somebody who really understands the halachic system, just to get the facts on the ground. The next step is to assess the reality, is figure out, okay, that's the theory, these are the relevant sugyos, now what am I looking at? What's in front of me? In this context, one of the thorniest problems that comes up is, well, what happens if the science, the halacha is based on a certain assumption about reality that we find not to be true? And we pointed out there that there is multiple approaches. You can either assume Chazal were right on their reality and therefore continue the halacha and just claim we don't understand what's going on. Bugs really do spontaneously generate and therefore you can continue to kill them. You can assume that the law is not really based on the reality. Really, it's a formal law. But, you know, they describe it in science, but really it's a formal law and it doesn't matter whether we understand it or not. Or you re-understand it. You know, you claim that it's not about lice being spontaneously generated, it's about them seeming to spontaneously generate. Right, this was Rav Shlomo Zalman, this is Rav Dessler. Then there are the people who just say, change the halacha, and within that it broke down. Some people are just say, look, halacha was based on false reality, we know the principle, we reapply the reality to the halacha to the reality we know. Other people say, misafik will do that. Therefore, we'll be machmir. But if push came to shove, we could be makel. Right? That was Rabbi Yasha's position. And we noted that it could be different in different circumstances. And that while many poskim think that in the case of spontaneous generation, we at least have to be machshiv, the metzias that we have, in trefos they don't. And that's already the Rambam. The Rambam says, really, it's not about an animal that's going to die in a year. It's about the status of a trefa. Right? The misura we have from Moshe Rabbeinu of a trefa. Another thing you have to do is assess, beyond the letter of the law, is the spirit of the law. And here we had a few test cases. For example, no Yehudan hunting. It's not technically usur, but if you understand, you connect the dots in the halakhic system, or the Ramban, Vasishra Shratov, Kedoshim Tiyu, you realize that it's just a medieval thing to do. It's who are the hunters in the Torah? They're Esav, they're Nimrod. And so in addition to understanding the relevant sugyos and understanding the reality, you also have to understand the meta halakhic concerns, for lack of a better term. Another thing you have to consider is policy. What's the effect of halakha on policy? Does halakha create policy? Is policy in addition to halakha? And we analyze this in the context of the Rav's tshuva letters on women learning Torah, where we noted that tshuva acted both as psak and policy. For that reason, the Rav bound the people who were asking the question to his decision before he was willing to give them a decision, because he wanted to be more than just a psak, but to be a psak, which translated to policy. Sometimes, and this is the next thing, you'll have things which it's only about policy, meaning it's not about raw halachic data, it's about what we call the slippery slope, right, where it might be technically mutter, but for policy reasons, we try to protect the Torah. That was the first thing here, protect the Torah. Now, in the context of the slippery slope, so we talked about a few different issues. Given the fact that halachic precedent is that we are allowed to set up slippery slope arguments, we're allowed to defend the Torah. So now how do we do it? So the traditional approach of most poskim, from the Medrash, of the Rav Nasan, through the Rambam, is that when you set up a slippery slope argument, when you set up a gzeira, what do? You make it clear that it's a gzeira. The other model that comes out is that sometimes maybe you actively want to make things less clear. You want to obfuscate. You want to say, no, if we let people know that it's only a slippery slope argument, people won't take it seriously. And therefore, we want to present it as if it's halacha, which you have tendencies of this in the Chasam Sofer, and came to a fore in Hungary in the 1970s with the Psach Din of Michal Aucha, where the critique of Ramshik of Hillel Lichtenstein was this point exactly, was that the Ramshik felt that even though we're going to fight the reformers, by which he meant the Neo-Orthodox, we have to do it honestly, we have to be straightforward. We can't, if you don't, you're going to be over Baltosa for the Rambam. And Hillel Lichtenstein thought, no, you have to fight the battle in whatever way you can, and even if it means changing Minhagim into Daraisas for the purpose of polemic, that is perfectly legitimate. One of the things I noted at the time is that whatever you think is true in theory, you always have to understand the reality you live in. And even if it was legitimate in the time of, even if it was legitimate, which I'm not sure it was, but in the mid 19th century, to specifically make things less clear, does that continue to be true in 21st century America, Israel, where people are more educated and you're more likely to undermine your credibility if you make a non-halachic argument into a halachic one? And that's just a practically, a policy question. We noted that sometimes you have mix of slippery slope arguments and fundamental arguments, which is Ramosha's position basically on feminism, which is that on the one hand, it's a slippery slope argument because feminism, if we give into feminism, it could lead to X, Y, and Z. It could lead to trying to get full egalitarianism, which is not halachic. The second point is, well, no, the fact that halacha can't embrace full egalitarianism means that if you are driven by feminism, by full egalitarianism, so that fundamentally is an attack on the halachic system, and we have to oppose it. So that you see sort of a mix. You see this, by the way, also in some of Ruf Schechter's arguments recently, in Ruf Twersky's article yesterday. You see this sort of mix where it's problematic because it will lead to X. It's also problematic because the fact that it'll lead to X belies a certain attitude about Torah. Something I didn't talk about when we did the shiur, and you can read the follow-up that I wrote. This was there was actually two follow-ups, because this had several hundred people following every day. This became very heated. I had many, many emails about this one. And this is based on an article by Rav Shurlo. He pointed out that really when you want to set up a slippery slope argument, you have to balance the gains against the cost. And he did a good job of going through the halachic concepts that get at the heart of this matter. For example, Ein Gozrin Gzeira, I left off the end of this, you can fill it in. Ein Gozrin Gzeira She'ein Rov HaTzibur Lamod Ba. That there's a gzeira that most people can't handle, so the halacha is what? It's batal me'ilav. It just you don't even need to be mevatel in Sanhedrin. If the tzibur can't handle the gzeira, it just dissipates. He points out correctly that what that the statement that makes about the halachic system is that if the cost is too high, it's not worth setting up a fence. The fact that a gzeira that definitionally is too difficult to keep makes the gzeira definitionally null and void shows that there is a cost-benefit analysis in gzeiros, and if the cost is too high, it doesn't matter what you're trying to protect, the gzeira is illegitimate. Similarly, gzeira l'gzeira, the fact that we aren't gozer gzeira l'gzeira shows that there are only certain types of halachos that are worthy enough of being defended. We try to defend our rights, not necessarily the rabbanans. We don't want you to violate Darabanans, but we might not set up a gzeira on top of a gzeira, but sometimes we do, right? Sometimes we do if something's really chamor, and this is what the Beis Yosef says. If what you're getting at is Isser Kares, or Avodah Zarah, or heresy, then you're allowed to be gozer gzeira. So you have to wonder, right? What are we really fighting? What really is at stake? Another thing is the Ein Gozrin Gzeira, by something which is not shchiyah, which is not common, which again is part of this cost-benefit analysis. If it's not going to be, if it's not so dangerous, because the number of times we expect the isser to be violated is not so high, so then it might not be worth setting up a slippery slope argument. Another thing you have to consider is there another way of protecting the Torah without the specific slippery slope argument and isurim that you're making? So that all that comes together to, I think, the what I would say, the policy aspect of Psak, that not the raw halachic data, but the but the questions that go beyond that in terms of policy. So that's, I think, section two. Questions here? Matthew?
So sort of the combination, to some extent, of one and two, some of which we didn't bring to discuss so much. So we brought in all these different issues and factors in making a halachic decision. What we didn't discuss is how the individual posek decides how which method or policy to accept, and so how does one choose, and or is it a meta question? Is it bound by itself? As in, are you bound by precedent deciding whether you use authority or
right? And that's a hard question, right? That's the thing with all of these is that I mean, if you look at everybody's tshuvos, right? I think, and you'll see this in the Tefillin ones for sure, and the Parnasha Minyan ones. Rosh Hashanah, for example, finds himself bound to the Rav's method of critiquing reform. Right? His assessment, whether you can agree with or not agree with, I don't want to get into that, that the current egalitarian movement, feminist movement, is the equivalent of reform, and therefore you have to apply the same methods the Rav did. What you see is that he thinks there's a method to applying the meta-halachic questions, the policy questions. And Rav Chorsky also, right? As Marenu Harav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik Zatzal said, Shas Hashmad is even when, etc., etc. But what underlies that shita is that there's even a method to how you apply tzeros, how you apply slippery slope arguments. Or they go back to Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe made this argument about, you know, Rav Aaron.
Well, is that authority, or is that trying to back up?
So, again, is it authority? Is it authority? Is it authority for the sake of authority? Is it they're just using the model because it was effective? They think it's the same situation. Right? It's not clear, but you see that's part of the discussion. Rav Aaron, for example, tends to disagree with this. That Ravana has said many times that the current situation is so fundamentally different than anything we've ever faced, and we talked about this a little bit, and again, I have a post on this, on the question of globalization in PSOC, is that you're right, that things have changed, and to the that whatever Postgame used to do, it might be totally different in the world of globalized PSOC. And, you know, Ravana really pushes that, and therefore, it might not be helpful to look at previous models, because, right, not on no level, because practically it's not the same, and halakhically, obviously, you can only replicate models if you're dealing with the same situation, not if you're dealing with different situations. But I think that's part of the problem, and I think part of the discussion now is trying to work that out. You know, you see this a lot. Who gets to make the decision? Is it the local shul rabbi? Is it the gedolim? Who are the gedolim, right? Who are not the gedolim? Where, when, who, what? And this is what people are struggling with, is who makes decisions, how do you make the decisions, when do they make the decisions. I don't think our community is at a point where we've come to consistent answers in that question. I think we're still... The world changes so fast that even if we had a decision 3 years ago, which we didn't, right, we wouldn't have a decision now. And the fact is we haven't really been good since the beginning of it at really sort of pin down how we conceptualize the modern era. You know, for example, there's a nice article in by your cousin in a book called Tikshoret V'Yahadut. So there's a few articles there about the role of Talmud Torah and PSOC in the world of Shud SMS, in the world of mass media, where obviously, you know, everything's changed. Ray Clapper last week published a piece also where he tended to think that Bizman Hazeh, you know, in a certain respect, everyone has the status of a posek when it comes to paskening drunk. Right? The way we paskin is that if someone is a posek and any shir they give is taken halakha l'maisa, then they can't even give shir when they're drunk because it translates into the psak. What he noted, just mitzias, is that a ton of people just go online when they have a shayla and they Google it and they get any Ask the Rabbi or any blog that discusses any shayla and they take it and they paskin for themselves. So even if the person doesn't mean to paskin, if it's going to be taken as that, then they have to treat the blog as a quasi-psak with all the care you need to take. So I don't think the answer is clear. I think we're struggling with these issues. Okay. You know what? Let's skip for a second, because I think this is section 4 that I put here, which is the question of who. And again, these questions don't just deal, you know, don't just relate to when we set up slippery slope arguments and the like. It's a question of who can do it. And as we pointed, look, on the one hand, when we're talking about Postgame Bizman Hazeh, it's so much more complicated in terms of mitzias, both scientific, economic, all types of technology, socially, all of it is much more complicated. So you need someone who can balance everything we've talked about. On the other hand, it might be that no one can do it, and therefore you have to move to a more democratized, specialized version of PSOC, which is going to affect the questions you're talking about, is how do you make these decisions and who makes them? We noted that there's difference between shaylas that have a chiddush and don't have a chiddush. That if there's a chiddush, you really do need to go to a higher level posek. And a chiddush for the whole community, you probably need to go to a gadol, whoever is your gadol is. Lower level shaylas, not necessarily. There might be a difference halachically between shaylas for yourself on private issues than for other ones. We noted also that because of all the complexity, one of the things that you just are never going to escape in PSOC is that a lot of it's determined by the integrity of the person making the decision. Like, not all of it I'm going to be able to come up with answers. And am I going to be able to prove that someone's misapplying the rules? But whoever is a posek and is actually responsible for halachic decision making has to have integrity, and we need to find poskim who we trust, not just their halachic knowledge, but their integrity to be true to the system as it goes through changes and as we deal with new situations. It also changes the relative importance of Bikiyas and Iyun. And, you know, as we noted already in the time of the Ri and then the Lecha Mishnah and then, you know, the Prima Gadim and Shlomo Kluger, they're all making the argument that the more resources you have, at some level, the less important your rebbeim become. On the other hand, the Aruch HaShulchan points out that yes, but it becomes more important to have somebody who teaches you what to do with that information. And, you know, a lot of the discussion now is about that question, is not just, can you research a shaila, but do you know what to do with it? What does it mean to know what to do with it? What do you need? Do you need misura? Do you need training? Do you need shimush? What do you need exactly? Do you need experience? It might make it that, you know, what justified sufficient research in the past isn't sufficient research now, because now you really could just run a Bar-Ilan search. So if you don't know every tshuva that Nodvi Yehuda on the topic, that might have been legitimate 50 years ago, and now it's not. These are all questions you have to ask and really affect how we approach the halachic system, how we approach poskim, how we approach the relationship between the gedolim and regular poskim, between the Rosh Yeshiva and Shul rabbis, between, and again, something we haven't dealt with, but an educated laity and a posek. That's a very different relationship. Do the balabatim have a responsibility, a right, both, to research a shaila before they ask it? You know, all these things are questions that we have to ask. Okay. Then, the next thing we did, and this was a good 6-7 weeks, was the exceptional cases. There's normal psak. You know, the normal, with all of its problems, right? With all the difficulties of balancing authority and precedent and minhag and realia and social factors and slippery slopes and spirit of the law and changes in reality and figuring out who should paskin. Even you get through all of this, right? Those rules break down when you get to psikat al chabashat chak. And under certain circumstances, the rules are different. So that's what we dealt with for a few weeks. What we pointed out when we got to the end of that unit, which was Akira Severmana Torah, is that both Akira Severmana Torah and Psikat al Chabashat Chak share something in common, which is that you assume the result. Right? Normally in halachic decision making, you don't assume the result. You go through the process, and whatever you think is the right answer, based on all the factors we talked about, that's the answer you paskin. But when you're talking about Psikat al Chabashat Chak and Akira Severmana Torah, that's not what you're doing. You have an answer you want to get, or in the case of Akira Severmana Torah, you're going to get no matter what. And you start there. Akira Severmana Torah is literally only result-based. Right? I'm uprooting the Torah, I'm posculating like it, and that's it. I don't care what the halacha says. Now, what justifies that philosophically, we talked about that, you know, the Rambam's mashal, it's like amputating a limb to save the body. Torah and Klal Yisrael are eternal. The theoretical, pure, pristine, platonic Torah exists there. And that never changes, but sometimes to save Klal Yisrael, to save the Torah, you need to uproot it temporarily. So in those circumstances, really, you just uproot it, and the result comes first, the process doesn't exist. The problem is that this is really dangerous, and even though we pointed out that there are several modern shailas where you'll see Akira Severmana Torah or Eish Lasus L'Hashem Yefir Sarasecha brought up as one of the arguments, like the Sridiation Kolisha, the Kesev Mishnah, and then Ramosha's very clear formulation of taking money for Talmud Torah, Ravadia Yosef and Marin Karaites. In all those circumstances, it's unclear if they're using it purely, like purely halachically, they actually think they're being okay to Ravana Torah, or is it a form of Psikat Halacha B'Sharat Chak? That what they're telling you is, even if I couldn't get to the result through normal methods, I would pass in this way anyways. And they tend to always mix Akira Severmana Torah with Psikat Halacha B'Sharat Chak for that reason. That they're making the point that they're assuming their answer. How they got there is not always 100% clear. Now within Psikat Halacha B'Sharat Chak, what we noted based on Rav Aharon is that really it's a sliding scale. When you're trying to figure out whether something is legitimate B'Sharat Chak, so you weigh plausibility versus necessity. The more necessary something is, the less plausible it needs to be for you to be willing to paskin like it. Right? Again, the extreme is Kirish Torah Minat Torah. I'm 100% convinced it's wrong, but I'm also 100% convinced it's necessary, so I will uproot the Torah. But anything short of that, so if it's a very, very, very strong tzorach, I'm going to be willing to rely on a gachok limitzchos. If it's only a little bit of a tzorach, so I'll rely on something which is a little bit less likely than 50-50, but not something which is crazy. Now we noted there are technical halachic questions about when you can apply this. Can you apply it against rove? So the shach thinks you can't and thinks that rove poskim is rove. The Bach thinks, no, Rove Poskim is not Rove. Rove is only in Sanhedrin, when everyone's there voting together. But a theoretical Rove isn't Rove. And there were a lot of shaylos that we dealt with in that shiur. What we spent most of the time doing, though, were cases. For example, Kavod HaBrios. We noted that Kavod HaBrios seems to be, right, first of all, not systematic. It's an accidental intersection of values. Because the Torah defines our Kavod HaBrios. If Hashem told us to give up our Kavod HaBrios, we would have to. Therefore, the only time we can even entertain Kavod HaBrios, either in its formal sense or in its sort of meta sense, is if it's not being used to critique the Torah fundamentally. It's not claiming that the Torah as is undermines human dignity, because that's an illegitimate claim. But if it's at this situation, in this circumstance, undermines human dignity, so that's a potential argument. That's the classic cases in the Gemara. The case of Shatnez in public, where Shatnez is not fundamentally embarrassed, right? Not wearing Shatnez is not embarrassing, but if that's the clothes you have and you're in the middle of Fifth Avenue, it is embarrassing. We noted that there's also, one has to deal with the question, is it only Kavod HaBrios for you, or for other people, or even for you? When do you make the call? How much of a bizayon? Is it only disgrace or even lack of honor? And these are many different discussions, but the basic point that we made with Kavod HaBrios is that it's an incidental clash with halacha, with limitations, and if it's being implemented to attack the Torah and claim the Torah doesn't recognize the value of human dignity, then the claim is illegitimate. And as Rav Aaron said, then you have to go to war against it. We also deal with Hefsid Merubah, which is classic. And there, again, you have to deal with all the things you would expect. How much money? For who? Is it a sliding scale? The richer you are, the more it takes for something to be a Hefsid. Now, there are poskim who objectify it, but Rov poskim, Rav Moshe, following the footsteps of the Pesachei Tshuva, says, no, it's subjective. The richer you are, the more it needs to be for Hefsid Merubah. The less, the poorer you are, the less. The Rama writes that often with Hefsid Merubah cases, what we're really doing is saying, normally we're machmir, but it's mutter mikra din, and therefore by Hefsid Merubah we can be makel. For the same reason, he says, that if something will cause a lack of kavod Shabbos, so then it's mutter even without hefsid, because it's the same principle. It's mutter mikra din. We're normally machmir. If there's a counter pressure, then we'll be mako. And there were other technical questions. In addition to the question of objective or subjective, do we look at the individual object or the whole situation? Right? Do we look at the one plate of china that broke, or the fact that you now can't use your entire china set? Okay. Then we dealt with minhag, which we already dealt with above, that minhag can push us to paskin l'kula l'chumra. He can give us good reason to believe one way or the other. I didn't put it here, but the Rav's claim that sometimes we just take history into account, that if the minhag has developed in a certain way, that indicates that hashkacha has led Klal Yisrael in a certain way, and we take that as a factor in psak, which will make us accept something that would be not necessarily the most likely based on precedent or original sources. We noted that URA is a factor. That sometimes, even if something is possible that you're allowed to do it, we don't let you do it if it's URA. And we talked about the different possibilities. What is URA? Is it arrogance, meaning internally, presumptuousness that you're showing off to other people? Are you formally taking on a status that is not your own, right? In when there's a hierarchy, right? Talmud does this, a Chacham does this. Is it a problematic because it causes machlokes? It separates you from the community. Is it a problem because it impugns on others? All these things factor into psak. Because any decision we make, any act we do, affects how we're viewed by other people, how other people are viewed in our eyes, and that's something we have to take into account. And sometimes that pushes us to be mekel, to be machmir. And the last thing here is chilul Hashem. That, we don't have to talk about it. And again, the importance of Kiddush Hashem, how bad Chilul Hashem is. But we talked about how that affects Psak, that it adds Yisurim, the things that are going to cause a Chilul Hashem, even if they're not objectively Usur, become Usur. That it acts as a factor to be Machmir or be Mekil, depending on the circumstance. We noted that there's Machlokes. Does it only imply in front of Jews or even in front of non-Jews? And that it can even act as a tosefet anisha, that it can cause us to be more machmir in punishment to prevent Chilul Hashem. Okay, so that is really my summary of what we did so far. And basically, look, halacha is really, really complicated. You know, I think just one of the things, I've had a lot of fun preparing this part of the series, and if I continue in the future, I'll have a lot of fun. I appreciate everyone listening and the feedback of everyone who listens online and emails me and reads the summaries and all that. And it's forced me really to think about these issues. But I think what's clear, and you know, here I just want to say, like, and I've tried throughout the semester and a little bit today to talk about the issues that are actually facing our community and how these things play in. We're at a moment in our community where what's really at stake is how do you conceptualize halacha? You know, that's clear. You know, all the discussion you see in every blog and every article and every editorial is what's the role of the Rosh Yeshiva and what's the role of the Shul Rabbi and what's the role of the individual? And what's the role of feminism in Pesach, and, you know, should we accept people's needs or should we not? What are legitimate factors? When do we have to set up fences? Are people being honest in their conversations? Are they not being honest in their conversations? Who's part of the conversation? Who's not part of the conversation? When do people have the right to make decisions locally? When do they not have the decision to make the right to make things locally? When are we talking about minhag? When is minhag not a factor? When am I allowed to rely on a shitas yachid? When am I not allowed to rely on a shitas yachid? All these conversations are very, very real. Not even getting into the question of places like Machon Hadar, which systematically are not working on Orthodox halacha. They're whatever they call themselves, halachic, egalitarian, post-denominational, where they have a totally different conceptualization of the legal system. There's a lot of ferment in our community about halachic issues and not local halachic issues. And that's why I think that it's important to think methodologically, systematically about what do we mean when we say halacha? How does the halachic system work? How do we understand how it works? What does that mean practically? Which is why I tried to bring in examples. And for the next few weeks, you know, until everybody's left or I give up, I want to do some test cases because I want to show you different places in history where poskim were faced with very difficult situations and they self-consciously made decisions that broke from the norm to deal with new situations. And hopefully now by seeing it in practice, seeing how poskim actually deal with it, we'll get a feel for how halacha worked, not just the theoretical, but actually watch it in practice. And like I've said, if you really want to understand Pesach, you know, this is not nearly enough to understand the theory. The next thing you have to do is watch it in practice. And there's two basic ways. One is read 10,000 tshuvos and watch how it's been done historically. The other way is to find a posuk you're close to and do shimush and watch how he actually deals with situations, someone you trust, both his halachic knowledge, his ability to assess reality, and his integrity. And between the two of those, hopefully we'll have a better understanding of how Pesach works, and you know, we'll be ready as to take on whatever it is that the future brings, because if the last few months have been any indication, you know, this is going to be the battleground, and that, you know, that's the feedback I've been getting from people who listen to the Shiurim, that this really is the battleground in America. It's what I knew from when I was there, you know, still only last year, but I think it's only gotten more so. Tov.